Imagine this. It's a dry, sweltering, hot afternoon. It's summertime. You've spent the whole day working outside around the house. Your body aches a little bit. You're tired. You're thirsty. The sunlight on the side of the house seems to say that it's 5:30 in the afternoon or so. The high color of the day is blanching into early evening a little bit. Time to start thinking about a shower and some supper maybe. But then you hear it. It's a low rumble at first, but it's steadily growing louder and louder and louder. Your attention is drawn to that hot, dry wall off to the side somewhere, still growing louder. The parched, hot dryness of that wall reminds you of how thirsty and of how drained you are, but the sound is still getting louder until, boom, crashing through that wall comes the giant red Kool-Aid guy. His redness is brilliant against the pale tan bricks flying through the air. His wetness and the moisture that splashes in his train are just what the doctor ordered. You can't look away. You can't stop your mouth from salivating with all of the saliva that you have to salivate with. Red, sugary, cold, wet goodness on a dry, hot, tiresome day. It's captivating, isn't it? Don't you want that cold, red, tall cup of Kool-Aid full to the brim with ice sitting on your porch on that hot summer day after you've just finished mowing or something? It's so red, so cold, so inviting, and the Kool-Aid guy's smile stretches from one side of the pitcher to the other. Today is Super Bowl Sunday, and more than the competition that will take place on the football field, today there will be an even harder fought battle for your and for the whole world's attention. Who will get the most attention today? Will it be the Bengals, the Rams, the halftime show? Any of the advertisers that make up part of the estimated $500 million that will be spent on commercials today, with appeals to your thirst, to your tiredness, to your sense of humor? Or will it be Christ's followers who get the most attention by living lives that the world cannot look away from? Don't be silly, you're thinking to yourself. Those Christ followers are outspent 1,000,000 to 1. And what they have to offer isn't nearly so brilliantly red and cold and sugary. Best to kick up their feet with the rest of them today, because this competition for attention is serious business. And is the church as serious about its business anyway as the rest of the world is about its chips and its football and its Kool-Aid? It's no small irony that Super Bowl Sunday lands right smack in the middle of the season of Epiphany. Just think about that for a moment. Epiphany, the season that announces the conspicuous, jarring inbreaking of the light into a world drowning in darkness. And how will that inbreaking light fare today against the inbreaking Kool-Aid guy? Today, in this last sermon of my incarnation series, I want to talk about one last, most important piece of the incarnational life of Christ and the incarnational life that we're called to. It's sheer conspicuousness. Is there anything at all to say about Epiphany, about Jesus Christ, about the Christian life? If there is anything to say about it, surely one thing must be that it's supposed to grab attention, right? Surely they're supposed to be noticeable. They're supposed to attract. They're all about putting another option before the eyes of a people looking for another option, right? A people perhaps that didn't know there was another option. The opposite of that word, incarnation, are words like unnoticeable, camouflage, hidden, obscure, secretive, imperceptible. Hardly words that are appropriate to the Jesus of the Gospels or to the people called to be in the world, but not of the world. Our gospel reading brings us today to the Sermon on the Plain. This section of Beatitudes and woes will no doubt remind you a lot of the Beatitudes of the Sermon on the Mount, famously in Matthew chapter 5. They take their name, Beatitude, from the first word of these short sentences, which in the Latin translation of the Bible would have been Beatus, hence Beatitude. We've been taught to translate that word as blessed. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the poor in spirit. But Jesus isn't just saying that these blessed ones are fortunate when they otherwise appear not to be. He's also saying that they're happy. That they're happy. The Hebrew word that beatitude ultimately comes from literally means happy. It's the very first word in our psalm reading for today, from the very first psalm. Happy. Happy are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked. Happy. That's the first word in the entire book of Psalms. Happy. There, in that first psalm, of course, the psalmist is saying something about how the good life unfolds. We are happier when we follow wisdom. We are ultimately happier when we pursue the good, happier with clear consciences, happier when we cherish and preserve what is holy in this life. It says there that the happy ones are like trees that have been planted in streams of water, which yield their fruit in season and whose leaves do not wither. They are well watered by their lives, in other words. They are fed and nourished by how they live and where they've planted themselves. They are happy, both in the sense that they have been put in the way of something that can truly deliver true contentment, but also in the sense that here is a way of life that will help you avoid many pitfalls. It is the wiser course through life. That is what a beatitude literally is. It's a wisdom saying, advice for life couched in an observation that people are happier and more fortunate in life when they do X, Y, or Z. That was the form of the beatitude that had been around many centuries before Jesus took it up. And I mention that today because in light of that background, what Jesus has to say becomes all the more strange and all the more startling. Can he really mean happy in the same sense when he says, happy are you who are poor? Happy are you who are hungry? Happy are you who weep now. Happy are you when they hate you and exclude you and defame you on account of the Son of Man. On the surface, it's not obvious how they're happy. And in fact, it would be a strange thing indeed if they could find a way to be happy somehow in the midst of all of these different kinds of circumstances. In the midst of their poverty, in the midst of their hunger, their weeping, even their persecution. Who are these happy people who have learned how to find their deep joy and contentment and blessedness even when the world seems to be going wrong all around them? And where does their happiness come from anyway? Because it's certainly not the natural response to what they're living through. Somehow, they have found their happiness despite. Despite the present sorrow, despite their need, despite their growling stomachs. And if I wonder if it's not because something else is watering their spirit in the meantime. Just a thought. What would happen if such a people were put on display for all to see? Might that not be a sort of advertisement in itself for whatever it is going on in the inside of them? When they face down their crosses with courage and hope and assurance, might that not be the most powerful way to say, this is the way? They would certainly be a conspicuous people. And it would be mainly in how they live, more than in what they say, that their onlookers would be led to consider a conspicuous Christ. Because you see, what they do by living it is to bring that option with them into the world, manifest it, make it available, make it present, make it real. They shine its light. They force the world to pause and say, now this is something to see. Where does their joy come from? How are they still standing? Where are they getting the fuel to keep moving forward through all of this? For any out there who are paying attention, I would think that would be more captivating than any 30-second commercial. No matter how hot the day or how red and smiley the Kool-Aid guy. Your life is an advertisement for the God who is dwelling in you. That's incarnation. That's what being in the world but not of the world is for. Your lived testimony to the living stream that God has planted you by. Where has God allowed you to live so that you can show the world that you are being fed by deeper waters? Let me ask that question again. Where has God allowed you to live so that you can show the world that you are fed by deeper waters? We follow Christ's way, which very often is the harder way, in part to show that we are fed by deeper waters. And all of God's people said, Amen. Amen.